In December, Scott Jensen's 8-year legal saga ended. In a agreement with the Waukesha County District Attorney, Scott Jensen agreed to a civil violation and a forfeiture, and that ended 8 years of uncertainty. And Scott Jensen has invited Wisconsinite into his home to talk about a number of things. Scott, thanks very much.
You bet. Welcome.
Thank you. You know, you issued a statement then. You really didn't talk to reporters, and that's why I appreciate the interview. Mm-hmm. You said, "I can see clearly now." Why did you pick that phrase?
It's one of my favorite songs. It's an upbeat song. It's future-looking, and it's after the storm. So I thought it was appropriate for it. I got a lot of ribbing from friends for the choice, but you know, not like I'm normally a Jimmy Cliff fan or the original version. But it's a song that meant
did
something to me at the time.
Did it mean you can see your future now?
Oh, no, I just think the storm clouds have passed. The sun is shining again, and I've got a second chance to go out and do something with my life. And so that's what I was focused on.
Did it talk about, was it a reference to the sins of the past? And by that I mean, do you think you owe any apology to Wisconsin taxpayers for how you helped run the assembly from 95 to 2001?
You know, I wish I could go back and change things. I can't. If I have a regret, it's that I came to the Capitol as a reformer, as someone who wanted to change things, to right some wrongs, and we did a lot of that. Welfare reform, school choice, the tax cuts, a lot of ethics law changes that we made in the Rock the House coalition from the state assembly, a lot of campaign finance law changes. So we did a lot of those things. It's just that I think the whole caucus system was so endemic in the way the Capitol operated that those of us who were there didn't see what was wrong about it. And, you know, I wish that I had been the one to see what was wrong, put an end to it, and move on. In the end, I was the one who put an end to it, but it was when others brought it to our light and showed us that it was the wrong thing to do with taxpayers.
Talk about the first day that you worked on something in the Capitol. And by that, I mean, that's when the first thing you got handed was a caucus-related political chore?
My first time I worked at the state capitol was as a summer intern, again, as part of a graduate school credit project. I went to work at the capitol in the Senate Republican caucus, and by the end of the first day, I'd been given political work to do, in addition to policy work. I was there mostly to help with what was going to be, in 1983, an economic development special session. The Republicans were calling for a special session on jobs, essentially, and I helped write that agenda. But that didn't mean we weren't doing political stuff. It was actually during the middle of redistricting the Capitol, about as political an assignment as you could get. So we were helping, trying to figure out campaign stuff at that time. So for my first day at the Capitol, which was also, I think, Sheboygan Brot Day, which used to be a great thing at the Capitol, that's what we were doing. And so that was the way I was introduced to it, and I'm sure that's the way hundreds of other young staffers and legislators were introduced to the Capitol, and why it was probably not possible for everyone to see what was wrong with this.
So it was so endemic, so much a part of the system, that as generations of leaders came through, they just accepted it. Well, this is the way.
Not only that, it got
done,
put into people's job descriptions. I mean, one of the things that I know frustrated the prosecutor was that some of the things that he was charging people with that were deemed to be wrong are actually in the job descriptions for caucus staffers. So, you know, that's how much it became ingrained that these activities actually got added to the official job descriptions of state employees.
In the wake of the settlement with the Waukesha County District Attorney, you saw some of the reaction. Your critics said you, quote, gamed the system by stringing it out over 8 years. There was other members of your party wrote a law that gave lawmakers a chance to shop for venues. Well, the reaction was Scott gamed the system and it didn't have to be retried on felonies. Your response?
Well, I obviously didn't game the system. We clearly would not have wanted this to last this long. I didn't want this to hang over my head this long. I didn't want to rack up these kind of legal bills for myself, my family, and my friends. I would like to have moved on with my life, so no one would have asked for something to go on this long. And the legislators changed the law, frankly, I think, to protect themselves from this ever happening to them. And it was only after that law passed that my convictions were overturned, and suddenly that law applied to me. I think originally they all thought that law was just going to apply to the state legislators who were there. And there were Democrats and Republicans who came to me and said, you know, we watched what happened to you, and we're just not going to let that ever happen to people again in the legislature.
You were the only one who decided, I'm going to go to trial and take my chances.
Right.
Why? Others, the other four legislative leaders that were charged, cut plea deals.
You know, I've talked with them about the decisions that they have made, and I think for many of them, they just felt they couldn't come up with the resources to defend themselves. And I was blessed in that we had an outpouring of people who came to our defense, people I have never even met before in my life, people of all political stripes who came forward and felt this was wrong and helped our family fight this and be successful. And other people, unfortunately, didn't have that outpouring of support, at least financially, and they just felt they couldn't sustain that. And I learned a good lesson there. I mean, I was always sympathetic at the Capitol when the public defender's office or the criminal defense lawyers would come in and say, you know, there are a lot of people in the state who can't afford to defend themselves, and terrible things happen to them as a result, and sometimes injustices are done. But we never had the resources to actually try to come up with a better way of doing that. That became even more apparent here, where families of middle-class means couldn't even afford to defend themselves and felt that they had to plead to crimes they didn't believe they actually had committed, but it was the easiest way out of the mess. And I feel very badly that they felt they had to do that, and very fortunate that we were able to continue the fight. And we're prepared to go ahead with another trial, and it would have been very different. I mean, you know, a lot of people look at the overturning of my convictions and say it was a matter of technicality. Well, not being allowed to put on a full defense is not a technicality. That's actually a massive flaw in a trial. And beyond that, the jury instructions were also flawed. This time around, had there been another trial, we would have been able to call all sorts of people to talk about what the system was at the Capitol, why people felt that it was, you know, part of their job to do this work. And the law that we were charged with violating, you had to have had the intent to gain a dishonest advantage. And I don't think anyone at the Capitol thought that that's what they were doing. They thought they were merely doing their jobs the way they had been taught to do them. So I think we would have done very well the second time around. Through all the first time it took the jury, even without being able to tell them our full defense, it took them 3 days to conclude that I was guilty.
So. You appealed your three felony convictions, and they were ultimately overturned, as you just said,
by unanimous vote of the appeals court.
You didn't appeal the seek to overturn the misdemeanor. Why?
I very much would like to have, and argue with my lawyers for quite a while about this, but eventually they imposed upon me and said, listen, the misdemeanor penalty is a $700 fine. Mm-hmm. How much do you want to spend of your money and other people's money to overcome a $700 fine? And, you know, I was already asking so much of people, and people were being so generous. I thought, I can't ask people to spend tens of thousands of dollars to overcome a $700 fine, even though I would like to have done that so that I could have gotten, you know, all of my reputation or honor back.
A misdemeanor is still on your criminal record. How does that feel?
You know, I wince every time someone from the left or even the newspapers point out that I'm a convicted criminal. I know that there are lots of people doing wonderful things in life, including a lot of other public officials in this state who have a misdemeanor, but it's... you know, it's something I can't go back and undo. So,
you mentioned your legal bills. There's speculation it cost more than $1 million. Did it?
Yes.
It did.
Mm-hmm.
How did you raise that?
As I said, we were extraordinarily fortunate with people who felt that a great wrong had been done here. People not only in Wisconsin but around the country who came to my family's defense, and we will forever be indebted to them for what they did. People, you know, $10 checks and very large checks. It was amazing. It was really amazing.
Okay, I just have one more question on that before we get into your first love of politics. You were charged when you were 42. You're now 50.
Yes.
With three young
children.
You
had to tell everybody how old I was.
I'm sorry.
No longer a boy wonder. Yeah.
Do you feel you lost 8 years, although you were able to still work as a consultant for a national organization?
You know, I don't look at the last 8 years as lost. You know, obviously, my career path changed, my dreams changed, but over the last 8 years, I've really been blessed, not only with the incredible support that people have given us, but the time I've had to spend with my family. You know, the work that I do, I travel a lot around the country, but when I'm home, I'm here. I can take kids to soccer practice or select soccer tournaments or a dance rehearsal or a Cub Scout meeting and get to stay and enjoy all that. If it were not for what happened here, I would have spent 8 years running around the state talking to people at fundraisers and, you know, doing media interviews in Hudson, Wisconsin or something. Instead, I'm home I'm helping my son build his Pinewood Derby car. I'm helping my daughter practice her geography test. So, I mean, that's all great stuff.
Your oldest is 12 and your youngest?
My oldest, Parker, is 12. My daughter, Tess, is 9. Okay. And Brooks, my youngest, just turned 7 last week.
Were they asked over the last 8 years? I mean, did kids get on them because of your legal uncertainty?
Well, if you go backwards in time now with 8 years or even to when the trial was, which is, I guess, almost 5 years ago now, they were all pretty small. Parker was in preschool and kindergarten at the time, and I think he did have one day where somebody said something to him about your daddy is going to go to jail, and I think that was, he was a little confused by that. The hardest day I had was coming home to tell my children after the judge had sentenced me to 15 months that I was going to be gone for a long time and that I would miss a couple Christmases. I
think. Didn't you tell them you were going to fight it and try to get it overturned, though? Wasn't that
we
part
told
of the
them
family
that. I
message?
Said we told them we thought that the judge and jury had made a mistake and that we were going to ask another set of judges to look at it again and see if maybe a mistake was made. But, you know, how do you explain to a 5-year-old?
And
my youngest, Brooks, would have been 4 at the time, and he just sort of giggled at the table because he could tell everyone was sad and nervous, and he didn't know how to handle it. So, you know, that was way over his head.
Sure.
My oldest, Parker, was trying to be a brave older brother and not cry. But, I mean, that's a very hard thing to come home and tell your kids that you're going to be going to prison.
You want to talk about the present now?
The present,
the
yeah,
present.
Sure. Yeah.
What do you do now?
And what do I do now?
Yes.
You know, my main work is for the school choice movement. So I get to
nationally?
Yeah, nationally. So I get to do what was my favorite issue in the legislature full time. And so that's kind of exciting to me. And so I'm a strategist for the National School Choice Movement. I work for the American.
Which is based where?
We're in D.C. in Grand Rapids. The American Federation for Children, the nation's largest school choice group. We're a recent merger of 2 or 3 other organizations. And I'm their senior strategist, so I get a chance to work on all over the country. I have special responsibilities in a handful of states like Wisconsin and Arizona and New Mexico. But, you know, I get questions and get to work with people all over the country on it, whether it be a minister in, you know, Kentucky who's trying to get something going, or recently some legislators in Tennessee asked, how do you write the right kind of bill? So I provide strategic advice. I don't lobby. I tell local groups how to make this happen, how to write good laws that will produce good public policy, also that we can help poor kids get into great schools. And my organization's focus is really on helping poor and working class families have the same opportunities as other families do to send their kids to a school that will transform their lives.
And how long have you been doing this?
So I've been doing that for 5.5 years. And when I started, there were 5 states and about 90,000 kids who were using vouchers or scholarship tax credits to go to private schools. Mm-hmm. As of this year, there are nearly 200,000 children, a dozen states plus the District of Columbia where there are voucher programs. And I think this year, 2011, will be our best year ever. I'm confident that we will.
And if you do your job well in 5 years, what's the school choice picture nationally?
I think a couple things will have happened. I think 500,000 children probably will be going to private schools. Poor kids will be going to private schools. That'll change their lives. But I think that people will look at education differently. I think we're getting to a point where people are beginning to understand that by public education, what we really mean is the public funding of education, and that people should be able to choose from a wide variety of options, virtual schools, charter schools, traditional public schools, private schools, or some new mix of all of those as the education that will best serve their children. They will pick different educations on it, and perhaps for each of their kids. Mm-hmm. Your children may go 5 years from now to the brick and mortar school that you bought a house nearby, but during the course of the day they might be taking a Chinese language class online with you know, some teacher in another country. I think it's going to change greatly. We will aggregate, the education will become disaggregated. And you'll be able to have the best physics professor teach your kids at high school about physics. You'll be able to have a native speaker of Chinese teach Chinese. You'll be able to
online,
have...
Online, right? Okay.
Online or...
Harvard,
you know,
prof?
Whatever. So I think all that stuff becomes available to people through a lot of things. And there'll be more public-private mixes, I think, coming down the line.
What's going to happen to school choice in the state of Wisconsin?
Well, Governor Walker ran on a major expansion of the program. I think there are strong majorities in both houses of the legislature for a major expansion of the program. I think we will improve and expand the Milwaukee program with bipartisan support. And I think that they'll be looking for other avenues to offer families additional options for their child's education. Maybe special needs scholarships, which seven states now allow special needs kids to go to schools that best meet their needs. And I think you'll see people in other parts of the state say, why just Milwaukee? Why can't our community be included in these educational options?
Are you going, okay, now that's what you do in your day job.
That's most of my day.
Are you going to continue to advise on campaigns? Are you doing that now?
I have helped friends run for office.
Do you want to name some of those friends?
You can ask me about them. But okay. I've helped friends run for office. I provide a lot of advice for free to lots of people out there.
Did you provide a lot of advice to our governor, Scott Walker?
You know, I most of my conversations with Scott Walker during the course of the last campaign were sort of at the personal level. I had worked with people around him on some policy options, but Scott Walker knows where he wants to go. He's his own man. Mostly when I talked to him, it was about things that were new to him. I'm running statewide. I haven't seen this before. Yep. Is this right? Do you have any suggestions there? But a lot of it was also very personal, you know, just like, you know, how do you protect your family during all this? And having helped run 7-8 statewide races now, I've had a chance to see that. I was very pleased one night when he called me one Saturday night, I think, and we were just kind of talking about, you know, how you manage this with families. And he told me that he was excited after his next speech. He was headed to pick up his son who was working at a local pizza place here. And that was their moment, was dad picking him up after work, kind of 10:30, 11 o'clock at night, driving him home. It was a chance for them to talk, you know, quite frequently. So I thought that was great. He made family a priority during the campaign.
You're still you're a huge political fan and a yeah. political player, and probably politics, aside from your family, is it still your first love?
Yeah, it is. I mean, I love politics. I love history.
Why do you love it?
You know, when I was a kid, my father was a history buff, and from when I was first able to read, a lot of the books that we got were biographies, and he taught me that one person can make a big difference, that everyone should try. It's my favorite political quote ascribed to either Andrew Jackson or John F. Kennedy. So at a very young age, I had a dad who taught me how important it was to know history, how much of a difference one person could make. And after a while, I thought I'd like to be one of those people. So I got fascinated by it.
You've heard Scott Walker's speeches a lot on the news.
Mm-hmm.
He can't give a speech without claiming a little bit of the mantle of Tommy Thompson.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you ran Tommy's campaign. You served him as chief of staff. Do you look, can Scott Walker be another Tommy Thompson?
I actually think that Scott Walker is going to try to be twice as bold as Tommy Thompson in an even more difficult set of circumstances. So Tommy Thompson did some extraordinarily bold things during times of great prosperity.
Yes.
Scott Walker is trying to do things that we talked about in the Thompson administration but didn't get to because they were so challenging in even more difficult economic times. So I'm impressed by the boldness of the Walker agenda. It's in talking with friends who work there, we've only seen the beginning of it. They clearly have a bold agenda, and there will be reform after reform coming from this governor, many because we have to. We don't have a choice.
After you cleared your legal problems, did anybody ever think about asking you to join the administration?
No, that's just fine.
You wouldn't do that?
I wouldn't want the pay cut. No, I'm kidding. I would love to provide some sort of public service again someday, but I wasn't looking for a job, and I understand. They have a great team. A lot of my friends joined that administration, and I'm really excited for him. I'm very excited for him. He really picked a great cabinet, and some just as importantly, having worked in the governor's office, there's a lot of really talented division administrators there. I mean, you need to be able to. You want the cabinet secretaries and the governor to lead and paint the vision and sell the program, but then you got to have managers underneath them who know what they're doing. And I think they've picked some good people.
You have.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, will you have no role in the Walker administration? Do you expect to be on a board or commission?
No. Well, maybe I'll be on, you know, the cosmetology board someday. But no, I have no. I'm not looking for a post, and I don't expect to be offered one. They can get my advice by picking up the phone, anyways.
The day that the arrangement with the Waukesha County DA was mm-hmm. announced, part of his statement said, you cannot seek public office again. Is that right?
I think the DA is probably right with regards to state and local office.
Because of the misdemeanor?
Yeah, the misdemeanor was a misdemeanor violation of the public trust. And the constitutional amendment that I voted for probably includes that in the things that disqualify you from public office. We used to have a constitution that said that no one could serve if they'd been convicted of an infamous crime. Mm-hmm. And nobody knew what infamous was, so Wayne Wood came and defined it for us in the legislature as a felony. And then I think it was on the floor that somebody said, well, any other violations of the public trust. And I, along with everybody else, voted for that. So I disqualified myself, probably
from state or
and local office, yeah.
But federal is a different story?
Just because it's a federal constitution and federal law. And they have had people who have been felons serve in the United States Congress and in the U.S. Senate. But
the obvious question, would you ever consider running for federal office?
I don't know if I could ask my family to go through this again and to have me run for public office. I clearly want to continue to be of public service. That is the vision that has animated my entire life. It's why I help friends who are running for office and friends who serve in office. It's why I've chosen to have my work be an issue, not be like a contract lobbyist where I have 40 clients and this week I'm selling regulatory changes for potato trucks and tomorrow I'm doing cranberries. Yeah, no, I mean, I'm focused on an issue I really believe in, the need for poor kids to get into great schools. I think that's absolutely important to the future of this country. We cannot have an underclass of people who can't thrive in the 21st century in an economy where you have to be well-educated.
If Governor Walker asked you how to solve a $3 billion budget deficit, you're a former co-chair of finance and a speaker, how would you advise him?
I think that they should go through the state budget and state functions with a set of questions. Is this a core function of government? Is this a necessity? Are there people who cannot provide for themselves, so we must help them? You know, have a set of questions and divide away the absolute necessities from the niceties and from the waste and luxuries. And obviously the waste and luxuries have been slowly but surely getting squeezed out over the last few years. Hopefully they'll be squeezing more there. But we're going to have to make some decisions about some of the niceties as well. And also just some of the ways we do things. I mean, you may remember about 5 years ago I was proposing that the state of Wisconsin sell its power plants. We own 33 power plants. Most people just call the electric company and get a hookup. I mean, but in the state of Wisconsin, our university system and our prisons all decided they had to have their own power plants. I don't think we need to have 300 employees and $235 million or whatever it is in invested in power plants in the state. That's not needed. It's not the 21st century. In fact, there's a great deal of waste in that. So there are some things that should be sold. There's some things we probably can't afford to do anymore. There are some things that we need to jump from, 19th century methods of bureaucracy to 21st century stuff. Instead of asking people to fill out forms, we should probably be using iPhone apps. I mean, there's just a lot of ways to move state government into the 21st century and make it much more efficient and less expensive.
Would you advise him if he called and asked your advice on how to fix a deficit to spend less on the five biggest programs, which you know where they are, $6 billion for K-12 aids, $6 billion for MA budget, and then you have 870 shared revenue, 1.1 UW system, and
corrections.
Yeah. Little under a billion. Is it time to spend less on those five major programs?
I think the key is to try to achieve even a higher level of performance with less expenditures, because that is what the private sector has done. And as a result, many of them have completely re-engineered their processes, changed the way they do business, reduced their workforces substantially, and done things that are really what is their core function, what they do best. And we need to do that here in state government. The wrong way to sort of try to reduce a budget is in this sort of situation is to say, okay, we're just going to have to cut across the board. Mm-hmm. Or because what you've got is the same old inefficient system with less money running in, meaning less people could help. We have to re-engineer the process so that people are still getting assistance, the right people, the right things, But for a much, much more efficient and much lower cost.
Union leaders like Marty Beal say he's about to declare war on public employees. What's your take on that issue?
Well, I think I stand with most of the public now on that question, simply that lots of people have had to pay for their own health insurance or a larger share of it. We have an HSA at this house. I'm a self-employed businessman. I pay for all of my health insurance like a lot of people do. I set aside money on my own for essentially my pension and my 401k. That's not an unusual thing to ask of people. Public employees are going to have to learn to live like the rest of us. Now, in this state, we do have some wonderful public employees. We're blessed with, I think, mostly a very efficient bureaucracy in the state of Wisconsin. But we can't afford to continue the way we've been going. So we're going to have to ask people to make the same sort of sacrifices that people in the private sector have made over the last few years.
Okay. Last year's elections.
Mm-hmm.
Why was there a Republican wave nationally and in Wisconsin?
I think the reason that there was such a strong wave in Wisconsin, where President Obama went from really one of the largest victories we've had for a Democratic candidate for president in this state, what, he won by 13 points or something, in what has historically been a swing state where the two previous elections were decided by less than 1%, to such a massive turn against them, where you pick up a U.S. senator, two congressional seats, both houses of the legislature, constitutional offices, was because the Democratic legislature and the governor in Wisconsin in the two-year run-up to the 2010 elections made all of the same mistakes that the Democrats in Washington made, and it just built an incredible echo chamber in this state. The overspending in Washington was matched by the overspending in Wisconsin. The overreach on what government is going to tell you about your private life in Washington was matched by the overreach here in Wisconsin. Heck, they even both tried to pass universal health insurance plans. The Senate did it here in Wisconsin in 2007, I believe, and they did it in Washington as well. And I think it was so out of step with the mood of the public in a recession where everyone else is cutting back. Their company, where their employees is cutting back, they've had to cut back on their family budget, and the answer is government just spends money like crazy, money we don't have that we're going to have to borrow and our kids are going to pay. I think they blew it at the state level as well as at the national level.
Is it possible that your party will blow it over the next 2 years and the voters will swing that pendulum back in 2012?
Well, I think Republicans need to be listened very closely to the public. The public has become hyper-skeptical of both political parties, and before they might have let people go on for a while, they will yank that leash so quickly right now. And you saw that. I mean, they rocketed in one direction, disappointed. I mean, in 2008, the country decided that they'd had their fill of a Republican Congress that wasn't keeping its promises in spending in pork barrel projects and ethical problems, and a president who they'd grown sick of. And they gave the Democrats a chance, but the Democrats misread that mandate and thought, oh, they've decided that we want neo-socialism in America, and away they went. If the Republicans make the same mistake now, I think the public will crack them up the backside of the head, just like they did to the Democrats in this last election. We are all politicians today. Everybody in public office is on a very short leash with the public. I think they're looking for true leadership here.
You gave me the right to ask you which campaigns you worked on last year.
Okay.
Rebecca Clayfish?
I did. I had friends ask me to help
Rebecca.
She
didn't do very well at the convention, so what advice did you give her then? Something worked.
Yeah, no,
she won the primary.
You know what? This election was very different. I got a chance to help a friend, Rebecca Clayfish, run. She really ran from the outside. She ran as sort of a Tea Party candidate. There was a lot of new technology involved in that campaign that I, as a 50-year-old, was struggling to figure out how all this worked. But it clearly helped her immensely. She built a grassroots network through Facebook and through other methods on the Internet. She lit up crowds on the Tea Party
did
circuit.
Did you plug her into talk radio here in Milwaukee?
We did try, but actually they helped define that race pretty much on their own. I mean, I think they decided that they wanted a non-establishment candidate to be the lieutenant governor pick. They thought that that would be the best pairing with Scott Walker, and it turned out to be correct.
So. Who else did you help? Did you help Ron Johnson?
No, I did not.
Did not?
No.
Sean Duffy?
No, I
Reed
didn't.
Ribble?
No, but Mrs. Jensen wrote checks to Sean Duffy.
I see.
He's a huge fan.
Okay.
And I'm a fan of his wife's. No, didn't work on that race. I worked mostly through my work at the American Federation for Children and at the Jobs First Coalition. I provided advice on legislative races, both Democrat and Republican, trying to elect good people on both sides of the aisle. And we did pretty well.
Where does the funding come from for the organization you work for?
From the school choice movement. We're blessed in that we have a number of good-hearted gazillionaires, as I call them, very wealthy people who think that the country has to fix this problem of poor kids not getting a good education in order for America to thrive in the future.
They're
investing, you know, money that they could be spending on luxury items, they're investing it in trying to get poor kids into great schools.
If it's based in Grand Rapids, is it Amway money?
The chairman of our board is Betsy DeVos.
Okay.
And she is married to one of the family members that started Amway.
Okay.
Or actually didn't start it, but oversaw it.
Okay, now let's talk about Republicans nationally. Ready?
Yeah, sure.
Who should run for president in 2012 against President Obama?
I really think that the mood of the public is not to elect someone from Washington who's been there a long time. So I would encourage, I hope a lot of people run. I hope we see a lot of new faces. I hope we see faces that people don't normally think of as Republican.
I have a list.
It was very smart around the country last year. You know, the Republicans recruited some wonderful Latino candidates. Governor Susana Martinez in New Mexico.
Governor Rubio Sandoval in Nevada.
Marco Rubio. A number of African-American candidates, an Indian-American candidate who I actually happen to know, Nikki Haley in South Carolina. I worked with her on school choice stuff. I mean, there's this rising tide of new voices and new faces, and we would be smart to go that way. Unfortunately, the Republican tradition is to go to the next white male in line.
Well, who is the next white male?
The next white male in line would be, I think, probably Mitt Romney. Or Huckabee, and I really think that we
should... Are you supporting anybody?
I know I haven't picked a candidate, and I really, I don't have to now. I mean, I used to have these people lobbying me to endorse them early, and now nobody calls, and I can take my time
to
make a decision.
What about Mr. Romney? Have a chance?
I think that it will be difficult for him to overcome the Massachusetts health care program. Yeah. He spins it as a very positive. Other people come to a different conclusion, but it's too close to what the president did.
You have a picture.
I find him a very attractive guy.
In that corner of your office here is a picture of Newt Gingrich. Should he run? And he appears to be laying the groundwork to run. Should he?
I'm a big fan of Newt Gingrich's. I personally enjoy talking with him when I've had the chance to do that. He's an ideas guy. I'm attracted to people like that. But I don't believe that he has the management or leadership capacity to be president.
Huckabee, you mentioned earlier.
I don't think he's really a conservative.
He isn't. Okay.
I mean, he's a social conservative, but beyond that, he was endorsed by the teachers union. He raised taxes to come up with more money for education in the state. There's some questions about his policies with regards to criminal justice. I mean, I think there's a lot of, he's against school choice. So, I mean,
Yeah.
So he's done as far as I'm concerned. So he's against vouchers at least.
Okay, Sarah Palin.
I'm a fan. I'm afraid the national media has damaged her. I think that it was an incredible injustice that was done to her. I think she's actually a very talented person. You can see elements of Reagan in her instincts and her style. Mm-hmm. But I'm afraid that she may have been too damaged. As a result, you might end up with someone like Michelle Bachmann rising very quickly. Because even though she had some missteps early on, it wasn't on the national stage, and she wasn't pummeled as much by the national media.
Which brings me to this question. Why does your party have to give two responses to Obama's State of the State? One, the official one by Paul Ryan, and the other by Bachmann. What does that tell you about your party in 2011?
That it is an alliance between the Tea Party and the traditional Republican Party. That is the majority we have built, and they both had a chance to voice their opinion that night. I think Bachmann was essentially speaking on behalf of the Tea Party. At this house, we were all very excited about Paul Ryan. We're personally close to the Ryans. We're longtime fans of him. Our wives actually shared maternity clothes back when they were in the baby-making business. So we are so proud of what Paul Ryan has done. And I am excited when I get to go around the country and tell people that Paul Ryan is, you know, one of our congressmen from Wisconsin.
What should Paul Ryan run for?
Paul Ryan should help fix the nation's fiscal problems in Congress. That's what he wants to do. I've talked to him about that. That's what he's built to do. That's what the country needs him to do. We need some really talented people in this country to assume positions like the one that Paul has taken rather than everybody quickly running for president. I mean, we need some really talented, new, fresh faces at the congressional level, at the gubernatorial level. And we really got him in this last election.
Should Paul run for the U.S. Senate seat against Senator Cole?
I think so, because he would bring the Senate certainly could use some more fiscal conservatives and some people with some leadership. It's traditional for those who served in the lower house to not think much of the Senate. But there's a lot of mush in the United States Senate, and I think they need some clear leadership. And look, Ryan is exciting people like crazy. I have friends. You know, the great thing about the school choice movement is we're like that initial, the first Star Wars movie, the bar scene in the first Star Wars movie, where there's all these odd different creatures from all over the galaxy. That is the school choice movement. And people, you know, I mean, I have a friend, a Latino Democrat from the Southwest, legislator, who always says that he is a near Marxist. And he and I get along immensely well in this whole movement. And that's typical of the school choice movement. But I don't know. I think we need, you know, we need new faces. We need some new faces.
Well, what about the people who whisper, "Oh, Paul Ryan, you should run for president"? He should not listen to them?
No, he's a policy wonk at heart. I mean, if you've ever talked to him, he's about to be given his dream job.
Budget Committee Chair, U.S. House.
And not just Budget Committee Chair, but they have voted to give him extraordinary powers to shape the United States budget. And contrary to what people think, the president does not write the budget. The budget is written by the U.S. House, and it's going to be Paul Ryan. I think that's his dream job.
Speaker Boehner, have you met him? Do you have a working relationship with him?
I'm a big fan. I have met him once, but he's very close to the school choice movement. In fact, one of my colleagues at the office is a former Boehner staffer. So we had office staffers sitting in the speaker seats at the State of the Union speech the other night. So they're very excited. I mean, he is, you know, he said he's going to propose one bill in his entire first term as Speaker of the United States House, and it's going to be the bill to expand the Washington, D.C. school choice program. And he essentially dared the president, if you really want to be bipartisan, this is where it starts. So we have the right man there to save those kids.
Can your party beat President Obama in 2012, and if so, how?
I think the Republicans can beat President Obama in 2012, but I don't think it'll be an easy election. I think there's way too many conservatives coming out of the last election thinking it's a slam dunk, we're going to finish him off. The president is a talented communicator. They understand how to play their base very well. The power of the presidency to convey a message and deliver votes is huge.
What did you think?
He now has a foil. The president has a foil with the House of Representatives being conservative. Okay. He has a lot of advantages going into the 2012 elections. I think in the end the Republican will win, but I think it is a mistake for Republicans to believe that it will be a blowout. And I think we will win by putting together a different constellation of states than we have historically.
The shooting in Tucson.
Yeah.
Was that a reflection of the harsh rhetoric nationally? Our political dialogue?
No, I mean, it's one crazed individual who sadly took a bunch of lives and hurt a lot of people. That's usually the way political assassinations occur in America. They're not particularly political. They're crazy people. But everyone then tries to read some greater meaning into the actions of a person who's crazy or evil.
You mentioned the Tea Party earlier. Is that going to be a permanent movement, or is that going to flare out, Scott?
If the Republicans are smart, they will nurture the continuation of the Tea Party movement. I know the natural history in American politics is for movements like that to be absorbed into the political parties. And that's the general center of gravity, because it's hard to sustain a separate infrastructure for a movement. Yeah. It takes a lot of resources. Parties have those resources. So most of those movements over the course of American history have been folded into one of the parties over time. But I think there is a creative friction. I think there is a healthy double checking that occurs when you have a Tea Party movement like that. It'll make sure that the Republicans keep their promises. And that's what will help Republicans to win in the future, is keeping their promises.
You're a student of the news media. When you and I arrived in the Capitol in the 1980s, there were more journalists covering, more organizations covering.
It's a crowded press room. You guys were like cramped.
We were
cramped
up. Yeah. It was right from the movie, the front page.
Yeah, bunk desks practically.
We didn't want the fire inspector to come.
Right.
Let's talk about 2011. There are fewer news organizations, fewer reporters. And as a result, you're seeing additional news services funded by groups that get their money from groups that have a specific agenda.
Yeah.
Talk about the evolution of the news media in Wisconsin, because you're a student of the media.
Well, thank you. I think that there's a great democratization of the media going on right now. Just as anybody can write a book now and publish it, soon anybody will be able to broadcast a news program, or almost anybody. The costs are coming down greatly. I was surprised, you know, when Rebecca Clayfish came to me and said she wanted to run for office. She said, "I'd like to ask you for a contribution to buy a camera." And I'm thinking, a camera? Oh my gosh. And she said, "No, I can get an HD camera for $129 and I can start doing these video blogs." And I was looking at her like she was crazy. But so I wrote her a check for $129. And the first time I saw one of her videos she did, I thought, that's good enough to be on the news. So it's become so democratized. So I think you will see nonprofit organizations get into the news generation business, that they will create content for particular audiences. In some cases, it'll be snowmobilers. In other cases, it'll be conservatives or liberals. And that you're just going to see lots more of that. And all of the models we've seen in the media are slowly disintegrating. And I don't think we know what the next model looks like, except that there will be lots of content providers, and that people will be able to get the news they want to hear and select it from the people they want to hear it from.
When we're sitting here in 5 years, are you still going to be doing the same thing?
I don't know. I hope so.
Five or 10 years?
I hope so. I've kidded the people in the school choice movement because they were so supportive of me and my family that I'm an indentured servant. They just have to let me know when I've met my debt. But I love this. I mean, the notion of helping poor kids transform their lives, and most of the time I don't get a chance to meet the kids, but about every 3-4 months I do meet some of these kids, and this child is going to be the first kid in their family to go on to college, and you know his life's going to be different. I talked to we hired actually a guy in New Mexico recently who got a scholarship, went on to Princeton, and was working for us for a little while to earn enough money to go on to one of the nation's leading law schools, from a poor Latino family who no one in his family had gone to college before. That's a cause I can invest many years of my life.
That's what I do.
Because I used to see those kids come to the Capitol and talk to their parents and think, you know, I work so hard here. I'm doing lots of things that people are excited about. It's newsworthy that we're cutting taxes. But I knew that more than anything else I was doing was making a difference in people's lives. So until someone shows me something that makes a bigger difference in people's lives, this is what I'm going
to
be doing.
Is this your first broadcast interview to talk about all these legal things?
Yeah, I don't think I've talked to the media in probably 8 years. Maybe I might have made, I guess, a brief statement at my trial.
I understand.
Yeah.
So why'd you agree to do this? I mean, you're smiling more. You're obviously at peace and ready to go forward.
Well, I generally smile a lot. I'm a happy-go-lucky guy. I suppose in previous times when I've been seen on camera over the last 8 years,
it was there's a lawyer here,
and they're telling
here.
Me not to talk to the media. So yeah, I mean, my lawyer said, please do not talk to the media until this whole thing is done. And so for 8 years, I didn't even have to think about it. But along the way, a lot of people said, you know, when this is done, we'd like to talk with you. And so I talked to Charlie Sykes last month, and I'm talking to you now. I'm not doing a PR blitz. I'm slowly answering friends' requests to do interviews.
Well, I appreciate that. Does it hurt you to say, though, I will never be governor of Wisconsin?
No. I mean, you know, I swear,
was a goal maybe 12, 15 years ago, wasn't it? You can see a day?
Yeah, no, that was the dream from really a fairly young age, that I wanted to be the governor of the state of Wisconsin, or at least some major player in Wisconsin politics. That dream got taken away from me, and I haven't yet, I haven't really allowed myself to think anew or dream anew and to think of what the next dream is. But I get past stuff like that much easier than the people around me. When we were able to settle my legal case, one of the first people to call was Tommy Thompson. He was like, "Why would you agree not to run for political office again?" I said, "Governor, it's not a matter of agreeing. I think that's pretty much what the law says. I can't." So, but he was very upset. He's like, "Well, I want to see you as governor." I said, "Well, I don't think it's going to happen."
It's kind of what you said in your statement. You can see clearly now?
Yeah, I think I can.
Scott Jensen, thanks for your time.
You bet. Thank you very much.
Appreciate it.
Great.
Thank you.